political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
And welcome to the political cesspool, all you creatures of the night, the early evening, and all throughout the day and night and around the world. I am the guest host for tonight, Bill Rowland. As James is out on a social event tonight, he called me and said, Bill, can you cover for me on this coming Saturday night? And I said, sure, James, anytime. So the fun is all with me tonight, folks. And we have got an outstanding line of guests ready for you tonight. In the first hour, of course, one of my favorite guests and one of the, I think, real, part of our intelligentsia on this show. If you can say that we have any intelligentsia, it would certainly belong, he would certainly belong in this category. And that is Dr. David Yeagley will be joining us in just a few minutes here. Also, in the second hour, one of the pioneers of the new right. And by the new right, I don't mean neoconservative. I mean, what the right became and the proper way, the direction the right should have taken after World War II. The famous and the renowned Eustace Mullins will be joining us in the second hour. And then in the third hour, we will have Cynthia from South Carolina, who will be telling us all about her troubles and trials and travails, in South Carolina in dealing with, a black neighbors, let's call it that, who have been harassing and intimidating and really almost making her daughter a hostage to racial intimidation. So she'll be on with us in the third hour. Great show lined up tonight. And a lot of interesting things happening also around the country and around the world. First, but before we get into that, I want to again welcome one of our latest and newest stations to be picking up the political cesspool. We are honored to say that St. Helens, Oregon, AM 1600, is now carrying the political cesspool. So if you're listening for the first time in St. Helens, welcome to the show. We hope you love it. We hope you come back. We hope you keep listening. And call the station and say, hey, you know, thanks for having the guts to run the political cesspool. And next week, starting next week, in Birmingham, Alabama, AM 1280 will be carrying the show live. So we're tiptoeing a little bit closer every time to getting in the face of Morris D's in Montgomery, Alabama. So we need to get on a radio station in Montgomery, Alabama, so that Morris D's and the Southern Poverty and Law Center can pick us up locally. But if they can't, they can always tune into the Birmingham station now to hear the political cesspool, one of their worst enemies and a great nemesis of the Southern Poverty Law Center and their mischief. So, again, once again, our first guest tonight will be David Yeagley, and he'll be coming up here just shortly. But there's some interesting things in the news, and of course, Dr. Yeagley and I will be discussing some of those things. But one of the things that really caught my interest this week was the apprehension, the fact that Roman Polanski, the director, Hollywood director and filmmaker who directed the film Rosemary's Baby way back in the 60s, was apprehended in Switzerland and is going to be extradited to the United States to serve, we hope, to serve out a prison term that he avoided by fleeing the country 32 years ago. Now, Roman Polanski, of course, has many ardent admirers and worshipers in the United States and in Europe who think that it is injustice to put a man of Roman Polanski's achievements and Roman Polanski's brilliance into prison. But let's revisit just what happened with the Roman Polanski rape case 32 years ago. Roman Polanski pleaded guilty to raping, first drugging and raping a 13-year-old girl. And he was so nonchalant about what he had done, he didn't realize that he may have to go to prison for a very long time for this heinous act. So when he discovered, after he had confessed to the crime, after he admitted his guilt, when he discovered that he might go to prison, he fled the country. So this is not a matter of injustice on the part of our criminal court system. This is a matter of a pervert fleeing justice and getting away with it for 32 years. But finally, he's been apprehended and being returned to this country. And what do you think that the Hollywood elite are saying? This is a terrible injustice. We should free Roman Polanski for all the achievements that he has accomplished in his life and because we admire him so much. So, see, it's sort of like the O.J. Simpson case all over again. It doesn't matter how guilty you are. What matters is if you're famous enough, you should be able to get away with murder, rape, or any other crime that would send the average American citizen to prison for a very long time. So we certainly hope and pray that if justice still exists in this country, Roman Polanski will be returned to this country for the rape and sodomy of a 13-year-old girl. This is justice deferred too long, and it's about time that he went to prison for the rest of his life for the time that he has avoided. He's had a 32-year holiday from justice, and now it's time to play catch up and put him in prison for the rest of his life. But don't expect that to happen, because Mr. Polanski has many people of his same persuasion in Hollywood, of his same background. And even some of these conservative people of Mr. Polanski's background are saying that he should not have to spend time in prison, because after all, he's a genius, and geniuses shouldn't have to go to prison. You know, that's the way it is. Unless, of course, it's an evil genius on the right. And then they should go to prison just for expressing an opinion. For instance, like Ernst Sundell and Germar Rudolph and a few others who are in prisons in Germany for simply stating intelligent opinions about certain aspects of Second World War history. It's okay to put those people in prison for years and years and years, but not a convicted rapist who happens to be of the Jewish persuasion. So, you know, you're going to see all kinds of outcries when Roman Polanski is returned. Expect his followers, and some of them, you know, like Whoopi Goldberg, a great admirer of Roman Polanski, has said that it wasn't really rape. The 13-year-old girl has forgiven him, and it should all be erased from memory. It all should go down the memory hole. Well, that's Whoopi Goldberg's view. But you can bet that if the shoe were on the other foot, if the circumstances were different, and it was one of Whoopi Goldberg's proteges who had been raped, let's say by someone on the right, then there would be calls for lynching. Don't kid yourself. There would be call for a public lynching, that he should be put in prison for the rest of his life. Consider the attacks on men who truly have indiscretions in their life, like the governor of South Carolina, Mark Sanford, or a few others who conducted affairs, or, for instance, John Edwards, for that matter. You know, they're being put through more harassment and more trouble than Roman Polanski, who is a child molester. I mean, that's enough is enough. He's got to go to prison. But I think there's something else at play here. Clearly, there is an operation, a worldwide operation, to clamp down and to punish child molesters all over the world. And part of the operation includes rounding up men from the United States who have gone on what are called sex tours in Thailand, Costa Rica, and other third world countries, where they can go to these third world countries and virtually buy a little girl for a nominal sum of money. So these rapists are being rounded up and imprisoned. And I think that having Roman Polanski scot-free all these years is interfering with the conduct of this operation. I think that that's what's going on with Roman Polanski. I don't think it was an accidental apprehension here on the part of the United States. I think they realize that if they're going to punish child molesters and child rapists in America, and they're going to pursue them all over the world, they can't let this big fish go. So I salute the American government if, in fact, they are rounding up and sending to prison these child rapists, and that includes Roman Polanski. So, Roman, let's see how you like it in prison and perhaps how you might have to suffer rape and whether you think it's a forgivable crime. Let's see how a genius being raped in prison might view rape after he spent a few months there. So, you know, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but in your case, Roman, I think maybe the experience might enrich you. On to other things. We have a number of things going on around the world, of course, and we're going to discuss these, but I think one of the most interesting, and I'm going to discuss this with Dr. Yeagley when he comes on, has been the, the revelation, or the news has gotten out, that Barack Obama didn't write his own biography, but that biography was written by none other than Bill Ayers, the communist left-wing domestic terrorist who Obama always insisted was only a casual relationship, only a casual acquaintance. And all of a sudden, we discover, or there's a strong suspicion, that Bill Ayers actually wrote Obama's biography. More to come. Thank you.
Don't go away. There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages. Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
James Edwards, not... This is Bill Rowland, sitting in for James Edwards on this fine Saturday night, bringing you some excellent guests for this show this evening. And the first one is on deck right now. Our first guest this evening is Dr. David Yeagley, musician, author, lecturer, runs his own website. That would be badeagle.com. He is a conservative Indian by his own description. And very impressive credentials, two master's degrees and a doctorate, Master of Divinity from Yale University, Master of Arts in Literature and History from Emory, and a doctorate of musical arts from the University of Arizona. Let's all welcome Dr. David Yeagley. David, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, it's good to have you back. You were one of my favorite guests of all time, and so when I got the chance to host the show, I said, let's bring back David Yeagley.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity to share ideas.
Oh, good. Well, listen, you know, there was something that struck me this week, and I wanted to get you on the air to talk about it some. I know you've got some topics that you probably want to cover. But one of the things that really hit home with me this week was the revelation, or I guess the confession, or at least the suspicion in some circles, that the Obama biography, Dreams of My Father, was actually written by his leftist acquaintance, Bill Ayers. What do you think of that? I mean, to me, that was quite a striking, you know, piece of news to discover.
Well, I think that that actually has been a topic in not so famous circles for a couple of years now. That even when it was being done, people knew that Bill Ayers was doing it. I mean, what they have found out about that book in recent weeks is just. It's an embarrassment. I mean, it's shameful, and I think that there are websites, there are so many websites that are into the identity crisis of who Barry Satoru really is. I don't think anything like this has happened in history and in American political history, where we don't know who the man's. It's to the point where we're not even sure who his parents are. I mean, if you follow the internet, I mean, it's a fascinating thing to follow. But all of these records are sealed. Nobody can find out anything in legal terms.
Well, it's amazing to me, though, that there was this virtually brazen declaration by Barry Obama that, you know, he was just a mild acquaintance, a familiar acquaintance of Bill Ayers and no more. And yet now it seems that the most intimate things you could know about a man were revealed or and then turned into a biography by Bill Ayers. But the question is, what kind of person is Obama if he selects Bill Ayers to write his biography? If he picks this man, isn't that a way of saying that Obama himself feels an acquaintance with you know, radical Marxist-Leninist terrorists?
Well, I think... You know, what kind of a man would pretend to the public that he didn't know this man? I mean, what we've got is it appears to be a liar. That, That's hard to digest, because when you say that somebody is lying, you almost put yourself in a suspicious category. But clearly he's been caught in lie after lie after lie of levels at which most people don't even comprehend. I mean, most people are not. Most people that have told a fib or a white lie here and there cannot comprehend the depth of smoke and deception that has gone on in this image that has been created by the name of Barack Hussein Obama. I mean, this really isn't even his name, you know. It's like this is some kind of magical fantasy formula that has been pawned off on the conscience of white America, that, you know, here's finally a black man with a chance to do good, and so let's all get behind him and show that we're not prejudiced, and we're gonna and like Joe Biden said, he's neat, he's clean, he's articulate, like most blacks aren't. I mean, is that what Joe Biden is implying, that this one is different from the rest of them, that all the other blacks are not clean and neat and not articulate? I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. The whole idea that this election and this presidency is something about is something other than race was just a fantasy. It's all about race. I'm sorry. That's what it is. That's why he's able to do what he's doing. That's why he's able to pawn off these radical Marxist views in every piece of legislation he's tried to come up with. It's because he's sacrosanct.
Well, of course, the election was all about race, but it was all about racial guilt, racial atonement, racial nullification. All the racial terms that you could use worked in favor of Barry Obama. I mean, they all helped him get into office. Because
it was blinding. It was blinding because, you know, the Anglo-Saxon American is a wonderful creature in this sense. He has a conscience. He's a warrior. And I say that as an Indian, this race, this white Anglo-Saxon race is a warrior race. There's no question about it. But they have a conscience, unlike a lot of other warrior races. And they're not into genocide. They're not into being blind to history. I mean, they think about what they've done, and they have a conscience. And I think that it's been taken advantage of. And, you know, maybe somebody can learn a lesson from this. I don't know, but you would hope.
Well, you know, before the show, we had talked about the Obama phenomenon, and one of the things you brought up was that he has virtually become the face, that his FaceTime is unbelievable. And he's actually now, even the left is talking about Obama's overexposure. You know, they've seen a little too much. We're seeing a little too much going on behind the altar here.
Yeah, I want to say if you have time tonight, and if you permit me to get into it, you might have other plans, but I have reasons for saying what I'm saying, and the fundamental basis of my estimations of American black people is based on the fact that when I went to Oberlin College, where I got my bachelor's, there's a northern Ohio town on the slave route. Oberlin is about half black. Okay, I went to college in the 70s, and it was very radical. Oberlin was the first college in the United States to admit black people. So there's a real strong black tradition at that college, Oberlin College. I went there, and I attended a black church for 4 years. I went every week, and it was a Seventh Day Adventist black church. It was convenient, you know, so I went every week, and I saw black behavior that is unlike I've seen anywhere in my experience in living in different places in the country. Of course, that's the only black church that I ever attended. But I got some standards of expectations in that little church, and that's the basis of my evaluations of modern media images of black people today. Now, I don't know if you have time to get into that, but there's some specific things that I could say that have influenced, certain examples I could give that have influenced the way I seemingly, some people accuse me of being very very negative towards black people. No, my expectations are very high.
Hey, David, David, we'll be right back after the break. Save that thought. Back in a few, and with Dr. David Yeager.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool Guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. Big girls don't cry. Big girls don't cry.
Big girls. And we are back. You have rejoined the political cesspool, coming to you this Saturday night live by internet stream and on several affiliate stations airing live around the country. My guest tonight is Dr. David Yeagley, who has joined us, the host and moderator and administrator of BadEagle.com. And we were discussing the racial dynamics of Barry Suerto Obama, or whatever other names he uses. And back with you, David. Just pick up where you left off. We were talking about blacks, your experience with them at Oberlin College, and so forth.
Yes,
so continue.
Yes. I want to point out one thing here, and this is just basic psychology. You know, birds of a feather flock together. Everybody understands that. That's a basic defense mechanism in the human personality. Well, I learned from patient observing and patient listening. I was the only non-black person in this little black church that I attended. You know, I was Indian, so they just kind of let me hang out there. But I observed the average black person is very self-conscious of how he or she looks. Okay, there's intimidation that they feel just being around white people. Okay, this is natural. There's nothing abnormal about this. It's natural and normal. There'd be something wrong if they didn't feel that way. Now, what in this Christian group, in this church that I attended, I listened to them talk about different things and very openly and honestly with each other. This little church, you could not fool them. They would not try to fool you, and they didn't fool each other. I mean, it was an experience like I've never had since when it comes to social or just sociology. And I cherish that experience because it gave me an understanding of how black people feel. One of the elders told me one time, this was back in the 70s, and that black is beautiful phrase came out. That's when it was real strong, and black pride was becoming real strong. But that black is beautiful thing, one of the elders in that church said, David, we needed that. We needed that. Okay, you know, a national slogan, black is beautiful. Well, obviously they don't feel that way, or that slogan would have never been invented. Okay, so we're dealing with a situation where and it comes out. I'll tell you who dramatizes this truth is a black woman, a scholar by the name of Nalui Rooks, Rooks, in a book called Hair Raising, came out in 1996. It's all about beauty, culture, and African American women, and it's basically about how black women have felt about their hair and their skin, and it's the history of how they've tried to imitate white beauty. Everybody tries to imitate white beauty. That's the standard. I mean, you look at the world, look at the history of who's in charge and who sets the standards. That's just the fact. That's the way it is. And what I learned is that if you understand that sense of shame is too strong a word, but just shyness, you know, like maybe I don't want to be looked at because I don't look as good as so and so. If you take that in consideration, it helps you understand what Obama and his wife are trying to do in spite of themselves. Nobody's going to talk about this, but you give me the privilege, so I'm going to say it. I think that he thinks that he's doing black people a favor by having his face and her face in the media 24/7. He's trying to make this country accustomed to looking at black faces. Get used to it. It's normal. It's not offensive. It's not a bad thing. It's not a step down. It's equal. Black is beautiful. I mean, he's preaching that message subliminally anyway. Actually, I think it's quite obvious that's what he's doing, because it's not going to last. You know, you can't wear people out like this, like he's doing. But I'm telling you, I think part of the element of why he's doing it has to do with his instinctive service to black people. He wants everybody to see black people 24/7, so that you're used to it, and it's not offensive, and it's a class struggle based on race. And I think that he's working against the grain, and it's not only not going to last, but it's gonna backfire eventually. I mean, that's my expectation.
Well, what I find disturbing and fascinating is that whatever effect this has on black people, and certainly I think this kind of exposure is sort of part of some. I've always said that blacks in America have an unresolved relationship with Africa, and they're always reaching out for some sort of African validation, you know, through clothing or music or whatever. But part of this, you know, part of all African culture is display. It's display, it's dance, it's performance, and so forth. And really exaggerated display.
Yes. Yes.
But the thing that disturbs me, that really bothers me, is how vulnerable white people have become to this sort of, you know, over the top display of, you know, of, you could say wealth, you could say of power, of, you know, the sort of performance that Obama puts on, is white people who ought to really have better sense literally fall for it. And, you know, their hearts swell up with this, oh, isn't this wonderful? And there is sort of a racial paternalism there that, look, we finally succeeded in making this as close to, you know, something as close to a perfect Negro as we could by electing Obama. And of course, there are two consciences in conflict here.
That's,
you know,
right.
There's the one that where you have blacks who are, you know, they're swelling up along with the Obamas, and there are whites who are thinking, well, we finally fixed it here. We've done it. We've elected this black president. Now we can wipe our brow clean of guilt and shame, and we can all start really being equal. But that's not what's going to happen.
No, and there are reasons why that's not going to happen. The natural division by race, you know, they're not even going to overcome that through intermarriage or even just making, you know, racially mixed children. They're still not going to overcome it, you know, because they're just in this country they are a minority. Okay, now that's one of the biggest races in the world when you look globally, but in this country they're a minority. So it's like they're trying to accomplish something that is in a little bubble, in a little teapot, in a fantasy world. And it's sad that such issues become so paramount when they're basically just it's fantasy land, you know. And the world laughs. I mean, they have to laugh because it's like it's not these values are so impossible. You know, we talk about racial equality. You know, what do you mean by that? For starters, that everybody gets the same salary, that everybody gets the same high level of social job. I mean, what that the concept is is ill-formed to begin with, racial equality, or really any kind of equality. But that's the one that's been used here. And I want to say this, too, that it's been studied, and this is just to show you, to emphasize how natural this point is. Back in the late 80s, this psychologist down at the University of Texas by the name of Judith Langlois, she started experimenting with babies, vision, infants, and their vision, and it became very clear very quickly that infants prefer to look at beautiful faces. And what I mean by beautiful is what everybody else has standardized as beauty in this country. It's pleasant, pleasing to look at. Infants, I mean, I'm talking about just with their eyes just opened and a few weeks old, and as soon as they can recognize things, they prefer what are understood by adults to be beautiful faces. Okay, so she and the people are still talking about that, still analyzing all of that. Psychology Today had a article written by a Japanese guy about stereotypes, and the title is "Beauty is Only Skin Deep." And of course, his article is illustrated by a female blonde, blue-eyed blonde. You know, that's the standard every time, no matter who talks about this, from what racial point of view.
David, you got another break? You got another break? We'll be back right after this with Dr. David Yeagley. You're listening to The Political Cesspool.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
This is Bill Rowland, not James Edwards tonight, sitting in for the illustrious James Edwards, who has a social engagement. And tonight our guest is Dr. David Yeagley. He was discussing race and other matters of importance in this country and on this show. And Dr. Yeagley, you were saying...
I have one more example I want to take from the black church that I attended for 4 years when I was at Oberlin College. And it's very simple, but I want America to know how some black people can think. And this is classic, and I hope everybody learns about this. The elder was talking about hairstyles. The elder in this church. Okay, now back in the 70s when I was in college, the afro haircut became popular. You know, sometimes it'd be 6 inches out, sometimes, you know, 8 inches out. He's huge afros. This particular church, now I can't speak for all Seventh-day Adventist black churches, but I can speak for the Oberlin, Park Street Seventh-day Adventist black church in Oberlin. This elder said, well, so-and-so's got a son that came home with a big afro, and it early upset his son, and so the elder says, well, now, don't worry about that afro. When that young man confronts Jesus Christ, that afro will come off. I never forgot that. What in the world is going on there? And I learned that these people believed that being black was not to be a marketable political item. They were Christian. The only thing they wanted to market was the reality of their personal experience with Christ. I never forgot that. Being black was not something they were supposed to parade. They were black. They accepted it. They lived with it. They knew what it was. They knew how other people regarded it. They laid all that aside. And that's what they taught people in that black church. Now, can you imagine how that would go over today?
Well, impossible to imagine, really, because all churches, black and white, have become politicized. The black churches have grown stronger politically, and the white churches are virtually insignificant. We've got a caller from Canada, Eves. Eves is on the line, Dr. Yeagley, and he has a question for you. Go ahead, Eves.
Yes, hi, long-time listener, first-time caller. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, I understand that black church want to be pro-black, and I have no problems with that, and that the white churches, even though they're non-existent, would love to be pro-white. And my question is, I'm sorry, I forgot my question.
Understandable.
That will give you
3 seconds. the problem is we're not allowed to have pro-white churches. Absolutely none. I mean, it would be great. I mean, the Newsweek article that just came out not so long ago, I said that little kids were racist as they were born. I don't know if you read that article or not.
Well, listen, there's a natural psychology that accompanies different appearances, different colors. Nature gave us these things. Whether you believe in God, whether you believe in evolution, doesn't matter in the case of race. We're different. We come from different parts of this planet. We eat different things. We dress differently. This is all natural. And what you've got to ask yourself, or what any person thinking about this, okay, if this is what nature gave us or this is what God gave us, do we well to manipulate this? Or to try to overcome this? Is race something that we should try to erase? Is cultural difference, our cultural difference is something we should try to demolish in the name of communist equality?
It seems to me that if we're born with this sentiment that white kids would go towards white people and black kids would go towards black people as an infant, that God gave that power to us to decide, right?
Well, it's certainly natural.
Before we're polluted, it's totally natural, right? Before we're polluted with all this media and all this, hate yourself because you're white, or hate yourself, or blame all the white people because I have Montagne blood in me, which is Indian blood. And I have a hard time liking it because it seems to me they're all acting like they're victims.
Well,
and I think we did some great things in the Montagne.
The Western world, of course, is the white world, and it is the strongest part of the world. It is the part of the world that shaped the rest of the world. And as an honest warrior, from a warrior race, I mean, I look at this and I think, my gosh, this is pretty unbelievable. Right. I don't have any problem recognizing that. And, you know, some people have accused me of being a white supremacist for saying that.
Eves, thanks for the call, by the way. Thanks for calling in. We look forward to having you on again. Well, he makes a good point. I mean, you know, this was a good conversation about this, that, you know, racial differences, you know, we're talking about the white church. The white churches, even the prominent conservative, you know, what you would call white bread, lily white churches, even in where I live, are doing everything possible to overcome what they consider a stigma of being a white church. And I can cite some really absurd examples. But whereas the black churches are emphasizing the black traditions of worship and the emotional traditions and the dress and the choirs and so forth. And it's just this strange, dissonance between the way that whites think of a church and blacks think of a church.
Black people generally prefer their own churches. This is another thing that I learned. They carry on a little differently. You know, their style is a little different, and they're comfortable amongst themselves that way. You don't find white people, you know, flocking to black churches on a general thing, because black people have a different ethos, a different style. It's much more conservative. Now you got some of your holy rollers out in the mountains. You know, they get into of course they I don't know who if they got that from blacks or blacks got that from them, but there's a lot of different styles. But in this country, we've got a fusion of marketing and variety. Diversity is marketable, for crying out loud.
Well, let's take this back to Obama. Now, when we talk about traditions and black traditions, let's face it, he was raised by white communists. and by communist Indonesians, and didn't see the inside of a church until he joined Jeremiah Wright's church. So isn't his experience alien? Aren't these experiences with black churches somewhat alien to him? Because not even Jeremiah Wright's church is typical of black churches. It's clearly a politicized, pseudo-Muslim church or pseudo-Muslim mosque, and not really indicative of even black churches. But I mean, he must have some difficulty overcoming his lack of experience with blacks.
Well, he is not an American Negro. As far as we know, there's nothing American about his blackness. If we dare trust anything he says about himself, the blackness in him is Kenyan. He's not an American. To call him an African American, first African American president, that flies in the face of real black people. I don't know how they can stand that, but in the great wave of blackness, that made them feel uplifted. And, having his face on the tube 24/7, that makes them feel accepted. That makes them but the honest ones among them, like the church that I went to, they're never going to be comfortable with that. They know that that's phony. They know that. It's a produced acceptance. It's artificial equality. And they don't have any taste for that. And I suspect that there's a lot of black people that feel that way. But they're... black conservatives are like a lot of white conservatives. They're busy. You don't hear much from them. They're busy. Busy making the world happen, busy working. But they need to, just like these so-called good Muslims, the conservative black people need to. I mean, the real ones need to step out, and make it known how they really feel. I mean, I don't even find in the modern conservative movement the black token black people that they have, they don't impress me. I don't feel that they're really in touch with themselves either.
That's a totem for white people. I mean, let's face it.
Yes.
There's money in being a black conservative, a lot of money, and it's a very profitable.
There's no money in being a conservative Indian. I'm on my own.
Try to be a conservative white Southerner. You're impoverished all the time. Well, we've got a break coming up, Dr. Yeagley, and I wanted to say thanks for being on the show again. We used up this hour way too quickly. It's gone by way too fast. But any last thoughts before we break out of this hour and go to our next guest?
Well, I think we should be ready to be kind and merciful to Obama when he falls flat on his face.
1 hour down.
Okay, Dr. David Yeagley. We'll be back in a few minutes after this break.
Comes your way right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and says, "Something's got a hold on me." Yow! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out. They were jumping pews and shouting, "Hallelujah!" Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his Fruit of the Looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the 8th.